You're listening to Engaging Scripture. I'm your host, Nijay Gupta. I'm excited to be talking to Dr. Dennis Edwards from North Park Theological Seminary about his new book from InterVarsity Press, Humility Illuminated, The Biblical Path Back to Christian Character. Welcome, Dr. Edwards. Good to be talking to you again.
Thank you, my friend. I really appreciate the invitation to be with you all.
Can I call you Dennis? I don't know, because we know each other and we get breakfast. And,
of course.
All right. Well, I'll call you Dennis. So, you know, I'm going to tease you a little bit because we know each other so well. You know, one of my favorite books you've written is Might from the Margin. So after writing a book about might, I didn't have on my bingo card that you'd write a book about humility. Now, people know probably that scholars have a precious short amount of time to write. I mean, these are your babies. And you could write on anything. You've written a commentary on First Peter. You're doing lots of new commentary work. So a book on humility is very few people write on this subject.
Yeah.
And as you say in the book, it's a much misunderstood, maybe even abused topic.
Yeah.
So give us a little bit of the backstory. When did this book start to percolate in your heart, the idea? What was going on in your life? What were you doing? And then when you decided, because I know what it's like for me, when a book goes from the just ether in my head to like, I got to write on this. Give us a little bit of backstory of that and how it got to that point.
Sure. I'll do my best here. I mean, of course, we're not all as prolific as you, but I do appreciate
it's quality. It's quality, Dennis, not quantity.
Well, I actually hadn't seen I saw a continuity between the might from the margins and the humility. But I think what was percolating to me, as you phrased it that way, was a lifelong sort of journey where I was trying to understand humility, because I would hear people throw the term around and some even directed it toward me. And I thought, well, what do they mean by that? And so I was thinking about this, but I actually wasn't thinking of writing. It was just more my own kind of curiosity. And then with conversation with our friend Anna Gissing, who used to be at IVP, she came to me and said, there's a series of topics we were thinking about would be good for. And one of the ones she mentioned was humility. And I said, oh, that's interesting. Mm. I said, I have been thinking about this myself. So this was a few years back. And I think maybe from the publishing side of it, they were thinking about those sort of well-known, I don't want to use the word scandal, it just sounds so crass, but situations where some pastors had been called out for their abuse or for for the way congregations had supported their bad behavior.
Narcissism, and, those kinds of things.
Yeah, exactly. And so maybe from their perspective, they thought, oh, it'd be good to have somebody write about humility. But it was percolating in me for years, and it just the timing seemed right to put some thoughts down on paper.
One of the hardest things to do, I think, is to define humility correctly and to dismiss or correct misunderstandings of humility. I'll give you a couple examples. You know, my children fight with each other. And so if someone tries to correct my oldest and they're wrong, like with whatever they're correcting, she'll say, humble yourself. And I guess it's a teenage thing, but she'll say, humble yourself. And I think the idea behind a lot of the ways that people use it is be quiet, be passive. I'll tell you a funny story. It wasn't funny at the time, but it's funny now. I was early in my career and I was in real big with applying for jobs. And I was trying to publish and I was trying to get my name out there, you know, the hustle.
Yeah.
And I was working at a particular school temporarily. I wasn't on a tenure track or anything. I was there. And the dean was pulling for me. He was trying to help me get a job. And I remember we came back from this conference, SBL, and he calls me into his office, the dean. And he says, people out there are saying that you're ambitious. I said, oh, good. He said, no, that's a bad thing. And I think humility means don't be ambitious. Don't try to pursue something big. Oh. And so I think people associate humility with smallness.
Yes, yes, yes.
And lowness.
Yes, for sure.
I love your title, and I know the IVP does a really good job with titles. Illuminated. I think what you're trying to say is, what is it really, or what is it biblically?
Thank you for catching that, because that was actually my suggestion.
Very good. Ooh.
Yeah, they just wanted to call it humility, and I said no, because people will fill in a meaning to that, and I want to modify it somehow. I wanted to say biblical humility or something, so we went back and forth, and Illuminated came out. But you're precisely right. I think, especially in Christian circles, and maybe there's a cultural component too, there's a sense that we can't let a spotlight shine on ourselves for the good work that we're doing, or we can't even aspire to excellence because that'll be seen as if we are trying to inflate ourselves.
Yeah.
I mean, this was the way I grew up, and I think that's another reason why I pursued this topic. I'm an amateur musician, and I would play my saxophone and flute and different things, and I just remember having, family members saying things like, well, stop showing off. And I thought, showing off? I mean, I'm just trying to do the thing that I thought I could do, or trying to do the thing. But it was almost as if I was seen as trying to make myself be important, So I definitely don't equate humility with smallness. I think there's some devotional literature does that. I think there's a sense that we're supposed to shrink down to be of any worth to God. Of course, there is a submission to God. That's actually, we can talk about that in a moment. That's what I do focus on. But I don't think it means diminishing ourselves. In fact, I feel confident it does not mean that. And part of my reasoning is, of course, looking at Jesus and someone I would not say diminished, although I would say he did not exercise privilege that he could have exercised. That's different in my view.
I'm putting you on the spot here. Can you give me a definition of, let's say, a biblical definition of humility?
Well, I tried to define it, and you sound like the editors now. Like, what is it? So I moved my definition up earlier in the book. Yeah. It's on page 3, I say something like this. Well, somebody asked me recently. In fact, it was Scott. So he said, what page is your definition on? I told him. I define it as this. It's humility starts as a submission to God. And I forget my verb. It either plays itself out or it's demonstrated in acts of peacemaking with others. That's basic. My very basic definition. So it's something that starts. It's a posture of submission to God that's works itself out in peace and acts of peacemaking. And I say peacemaking kind of deliberately because it's not that I, again, diminish myself, but what does the circumstances call for my community or for me to be peacemakers? Because I see humility as also a corporate kind of a thing. And so it's not just, there are times when it might mean I need to keep my mouth shut because right now the peacemaking thing that's going on requires me to pay more attention. Then there's times for peacemaking, I need to speak up. In fact, I think there were too many times in my life I did not speak up and I took too passive a role in things. And that also caused confusion and disappointment. And I don't think that was the humble thing because the spotlight was on me. Maybe that was actually narcissistic of me to not engage because I was thinking too much about how I would be perceived. So I think sometimes the circumstances mean speaking up. Sometimes it means holding back, but it's still a peacemaking posture.
Yeah, I like that. Let's talk through some biblical texts because you're a biblical scholar and you're a pastor, but obviously this is your training. So let's start with Moses. Moses, the most humble man. Yes. What does it mean? What does it mean when the Old Testament talks about Moses? We make jokes about it, but what do you think it really means when the Pentateuch indicates his character of humility?
Yeah, and I think where we see that passage gives us a clue because it's sort of parenthetical there in Numbers 12, right after his siblings have accused him of making some move in marrying this African woman that showed him to have a special relationship with God. So that's their accusation. They'll say, has God only spoken to Moses? Doesn't he speak to us too? So I think that the issue here isn't that Moses is too grand a person To be, let's put it this way. It's not so much about his ego as it is about his status. That's what's being questioned. Mm. So I think that what to say he's humble is that he enjoys an intimacy with God that plays itself out in this wonderful relationship that he has. And that God says in that passage, right. I speak to Moses mouth to mouth, literally pay.
Yeah.
I speak to him face to face. So I think that, so for me, I took that to mean that Moses' posture of humility is his submission to God. And then what we see him in those two, in chapter 11 and 12 doing is always advocating for the people. He prays for them. He prays for Miriam after she is smitten with leprosy. And he's always advocating. He's always trying to get the community to be in the right place with God and takes that responsibility on himself. So I see those as acts of humility.
Let's turn to Jesus. Jesus turned over tables. He mm-hmm. condemned various people. He yeah. was a prophet who called out people for their sin. He partnered with John the Baptist, who was pretty fiery. Yeah. So Jesus was anything but quiet and mousy.
Right. Yes. Right. Anything but quiet and mousy. I like that. Thank you. So that bolsters our argument, because right in the same book where we see him say, woe to you, and yeah. he calls out particular scribes and Pharisees and hypocrites as hypocrites. And it's in that same book of Matthew that he self-describes as lowly, right? Or gentle, it is gentle and humble of heart, we could translate it. And so he postures himself as, look, you can come to me and take on my yoke and my burden. It's light, it's easy. Because I'm gentle. So that very same book, he can, call out the hypocrites. So I think that I've been trying to say that humility, again, is a submission to God. It's going to play itself out. So humble people will act on behalf of those who are most likely to not have a voice. So for Jesus to advocate for justice and to call out injustice with the scribes and Pharisees, that's an act of humility in my view. So it's not, again, it's not about diminishing ourselves. It's about advocating and peacemaking, especially for those who are in the margins.
One of my favorite parts of Might from the Margins is when, I think it's that book where you quote from Black Panther, where this,
yeah.
I've talked about this with you before, right. where this white man comes in and tries to kind of tell them what to do. And then the leader of one of the tribes starts barking. He starts
yes,
barking
yes.
at him. That's not humble, but you're not saying that there's no place for protest. You're not saying there's no place even for acts of power. So how do you
that's
put
right,
together,
right.
I know you're not saying that humility is an activity. It's more of a disposition.
Yeah.
But how do you know when to be solemn or quiet?
Yeah.
Or just lamenting, and when to, I'm not going to say violent because that's not appropriate, but when
right.
to show power and show force.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. To go back to the Black Panther example, I actually wasn't trying to say that the Jabari tribe was doing the right thing by drowning this guy out, but maybe they were. I mean, the only thing I wanted to condemn was the guy assuming that he could speak for people from Wakanda, and he's not from Wakanda. But yeah. More to your point, though, is I do think there are that the advocacy on behalf of those who are weak is a leveraging of our relative privilege, or it's speaking up when we are likely to be taken advantage of. Those kinds of things are not. Those are not arrogant things. Those are the calls for justice is not arrogance in my view. Now, that's a harder thing to contextualize. You're the expert now because I'm looking to you to talk about life in the first century. But I would imagine that, it's hard to talk about the early church's advocacy for justice in the, in the Roman Empire. But yeah. it is right to say they could advocate for what's just in their communities, right? Like in Corinth, when you've got the wealthy exploiting the poor and the enslaved in the way they were even having their communion meal or their agape feast. Right. So there is a call for justice there. And Paul says, look, you have to wait for you know, these folks. You have to put yourself, you have to lay aside your privilege, in essence. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that that's always the right thing to call for. So I would say Paul, even in doing that, was acting humbly in that he's requiring them to do the thing that is just and right, and not just coming in and creating some violent havoc or something like that. I think you're getting it.
I think most important points you make in your book is that we have to not connect humility to passivity. And kind of what That's you've right. been just saying is it's even more activity because you're always doing what God wants and not what you want. And sometimes what you want to do is to back out of it, not be involved, or to shy away, or even to protect yourself.
Yeah.
And what you're saying is humility isn't about what you're doing or not doing. It's where that decision-making process comes from.
Oh, my goodness. That's a great summary. I appreciate that you saw it like that, because that's exactly right. I mean, some people have asked me, well, for more specific how-tos. And I said, well, hows are always contextual. You know, but in your particular context, you just painted the picture that I'm trying to say, is that in whatever the context might be, there's a posture that we come in with that allows us to say, how can I be, or how can we be, the peacemakers here? And in some cases, that does mean upsetting the apple cart because things are not right and we've got to get them back where they should be. Or in other places, it means I pull back because I'm overbearing, I'm overpowering in this situation, and that's not the way that's going to bring out the best in other people. So I definitely think it's we pay attention to the situations. And my submission to God, ideally, right? I mean, and it would be, I would get those cues and pay attention.
I'm gonna put you on the spot exegetically, so feel free to punt if you don't feel like you can answer this question. But in some of the courses I teach, I regularly teach on the Beatitudes, and it begins with blessed are the meek, blessed are the poor in spirit, but then it goes on to blessed are the meek.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always wrestled with, I'm sure you've talked about this, but I don't remember. I've always wrestled with, is Jesus saying, blessed are those who have been put low, as in the people that have been marginalized? Or is he saying, blessed are those who are humble in their own virtue and spirit?
Yeah.
You could go in two different directions. One direction would say, kind of a political thing, God is turning the world upside down and he's blessing the people at the bottom.
Yeah.
Whether they're virtuous or not, because, you know, just like Mary says, you know, he's going to pull rulers down. He doesn't say he's going to pull bad rulers. She says he's going to pull rulers. Yeah. He's going to send the rich away, you know, empty. He doesn't say the bad rich. He says the rich. So is Jesus making a statement about society? Or is Jesus making a statement about virtue? I really go back and forth on this, and I don't know.
Well, I have tended, and we keep bringing up Scott, or at least I keep bringing up Scott. So he's written on the Sermon on the Mount, right? But I tend to take that somewhat Adam Baptist view that we are talking about people who already possess this status, and because the way I'm thinking is that by the outside onlooker onto these people, one would think that they're gonna that there's nothing working in their favor, right? The ones who are mourning, the ones who are low, you know. And so the turning of the tables in that situation is that God is on the side of these folks. And so I do see it as a justice turning of the tables. So I see it as the meek there would be folks who have been put into a marginal space. And here is the turning of the tables. They're going to inherit the land. So it's going to be, so that's the way I tend to see it, is that justice lens. And I do mention that passage in the book at some point, but yeah, so that's the way I think of it. In fact, you know, there's nothing virtuous about being humiliated,
right?
Except that God has worked in that power, in that space, to show power, which is the Might from the Margins book. Yeah. So I'm saying that, yeah, I think that verse is consistent with that kind of thinking, is that you've been pushed to the side, but ultimately God, you know, he shows favor to the humble.
Yeah. Again, putting you on the spot, if you had to come up with the right word.
Yeah.
Because meek, you know, that's not a great word for today. But humble kind of assumes a particular attribute versus a status. Is there a better word like the marginalized? Or is there a better way to express that more political, economic, status-oriented aspect of it?
I think marginalized. I would even say humiliated works in a way, except marginalized is better, I think, in the sense for that idea.
Yeah.
I think you're right. I mean, what is it? It's praus. So there's a sense of we talked about this before, I think you and I, but the that there is a sense of being calm, I guess, or tranquil or gentle and such.
Right.
But I think contextually we are talking about folks who've been pushed to the side, and often then they are viewed as weak and quiet and passive and such because they've been pushed to the side. So I think marginalized is a good way. I haven't done a dynamic translation of the Beatitudes. That might be a good.
Yeah. You might even say silenced. I mean, talking about kind of humbled, humiliated, you're putting them at such a distance, you can't even hear them anymore.
Yeah. Well
and
said.
So, okay, we'll need to write like some kind of political commentary.
Actually, I mean, I like that. I'll think more about that, but I like that. And then yet the turning of tables that they will inherit the land.
They get a seat at the table.
That blessing. They get their seat at the table, right?
Yeah. Now, one of your expertise areas is First Peter. And we've already talked a little bit about how at least your publisher was thinking about scandals with pastors. And First Peter talks about shepherds.
Yeah.
Talk to me about, so you have two sides to your story. You have an academic side where you teach at a seminary and you write books. But then you also have a pastoral side where you spent many years in pastoral ministry in the trenches, so to speak. You know what it's like to be a pastor. You know what it's like to struggle as a pastor in terms of the congregation. You also know the temptations of pastors, of the spotlight, the narcissism, and all that, just because that's in the water. If you were to ask to speak to a denomination or a group, I'm sure you would do this all the time, about how do we right the ship of evangelicalism? I know you're not an evangelical insider in the same way that like a Tim Keller was, but if you were to ask to speak to a group of evangelicals that exist in that attractional build them big, build them shiny kind of space. And you're talking about the role of the pastor, the persona of the pastor, how we can get to the other side of what's happening in terms of spiritual abuse and narcissism and all of that. In light of your book, Humility Illuminated, what would be some of the things you want to point people to talk about in that?
Yeah, I do very much appreciate that question. I sort of imagine myself having opportunities to do that kind of thing. And it's happened at least in my denomination.
Yeah.
When I went to 1 Peter 5, I spent a lot of time there because that image of guarding the flock, or even seeing people as sheep and needing the protection and care and the guardianship that is talked about there, is sometimes already a paradigm shift for some leaders who see people as workers, or objects of to turn their admiration back on them. You know, I don't know a good word for that, but you know what I mean. They see people as targets. They see people in a way that's somewhat utilitarian, and not always as sheep who need care and protection and guidance. So that's born in the word pastor. At least it's supposed to be born in the word pastor. Although some of us, I think, have changed that to that notion of, you know, power leader or something. So first is that paradigm shift of saying people are sheep and need to be cared for. And then secondly, it's the other thing that he says there is ultimately is to be an example to the flock. So you guard the sheep, but then you're an example. Now you're going to be an example one way or another anyway, I think a bad one or a good one, but I think you're supposed to set a good example for the sheep. So in how we live. So for me, the paradigm is what's going to take for me to understand that people are like sheep and that I have this opportunity and this call to help guard and care for them And then also to be an example of how we should live. That's very sobering in my mind. It's actually even frightening to think to be this an example for people. But to me, that it also invites a kind of a collaboration that I don't always see in leadership. Leaders tell people what to do and people are supposed to respond. I see leaders as helping to bring out the best in people. So there's a very collaborative kind of thing. When I served at a church and I was leaving and we were trying to work through the transition, it was a good transition. It wasn't like, you know, they kicked me out. It was actually when I left the church to become a full-time Bible instructor. It was a nice transition. And one of the young leaders said, you lead with open hands, she said. And I thought, wow, I like that image. In fact, I said something about that. And one of the cover choices for the book was a pair of open hands, but I don't think anybody would have got it. So we changed the cover. But so I guess that's the kind of thing I would want to encourage. What does leading with open hands look like? But part of what happens in all this conversation we're having, EJ, is that something in the back is happening. Is that pastor, he or she has to think something is going to get something's going to get sacrificed here. And it might be a huge congregation, or it might be having my name be really, you know, elevated, because to do that kind of work of caring for people, being collaborative, guarding the sheep, it might mean that I have fewer sheep. It might mean that, something is going to be a little bit different. And in the big attractional thing, that's just a very American thing, in my view. It says that's how we measure success, is to have a lot of numbers and big. And I'm not against big, so I don't want to say that, but I don't think pursuing the big is the goal if it's really about, you know, nurturing sheep.
What you have to sacrifice, what you have to give up.
Yeah.
What do you want? I mean, whenever a book comes out, I mean, you put your blood, sweat, and tears in it, and you know, you want it to be read, you want it to resonate, you want to leave an impact. What kind of impact do you want? Do you hope this book will have when you put it in the hands of your students, when you realize it's getting reviewed and getting read? What's the wish 5-10 years from now that this is a meteor hitting and leaving a crater? What's that crater look like?
Wow, man, you ask good questions, bro. One of them is I don't want to just reduce the temperature in the conversations that, you know, Christians are having in this world. I'm not against heated conversation, but I am against vitriol and kind of the inability that we have to truly pay attention to one another. I'm not saying that everybody's right. I'm not saying it's just both sides are equal. I'm not saying that some things are wrong and some things are true. But if we can't stop and pay attention to what's out there, what's being said, and who's saying it and how they're saying it, I mean, all of that is part of good communication. So for me, I think that big crater I want is for us to stop and say, as Christian people, we're going to be known for a character that embraces submission to God and strives to be peacemakers. And that's the kind of humility. So I would hope to see some healing happening, some confession happening, some new alliances being made among people, and that there would be a general witness to the onlooking world that, wow, these Christians, they're not trying to, you know, take over the world with their political might. They're trying to love us so much that we can't help but to see Jesus. I mean, that's what I really hope for. I mean, it's as idealistic as that sounds.
Yeah. Well, that's the dream, and any little bit you can do helps.
That's right.
Well, we have to wrap up, so thank you so much for this conversation about your book. To those that are listening, check out Dr. Dennis Edwards' book, Humility Illuminated, The Biblical Path Back to Christian Character. I wish the book well. Hope it gets read, and more importantly, gets metabolized into the lives of pastors, churches, and Christians everywhere.
Thank you. Thank you.